I just want to review a few points that we made last week. I don't know who was here, who was not.
Did you push the button?
Yes. And we're talking about the Iser Lav, the Torah prohibits, Lo Tasun, Iti. We're not allowed to make images. And the question is, are we allowed to benefit from these images? That's called in halacha terms, Isurei Hanah. There's certain things that are designated for idol worship. And as a result, you're not allowed to benefit from them. For example, a person creates an image of the sun, perhaps the moon, perhaps the stars, or even a human image. Once that image is worshipped, it becomes avodah zarah, which means you're not allowed to have any benefits whatsoever. However, in the case of a Jew who's interested in creating images, presumably, let's be dalakav schut, as we say, we'll judge him in a favorable way. He or she is not interested in idol worship. Yet the Torah says, avoid these beautiful images of celestial spheres, because that's what the idol worshippers back in the day would worship. And the Torah wants to keep us very, very far away from creating images which would be used for idol worship. And therefore the Torah says, don't create those images. Last week, we discussed the issue of taking out a piece of paper and making an image of the sun, or something that represents the sun. We spoke about creating an image of a star in order to teach astronomy, for example. We mentioned that violating this prohibition, when it applies, entails not only creating the image, but once the image has been created, to hold on to that image, to maintain possession of the image. We discussed the following possible leniencies that might give license to create images. Perhaps, when the image is created on a two-dimensional surface, it's not three-dimensional, then there's one opinion that would allow that. Although, we don't accept that opinion, but we'll use it, if need be, when we can combine it with another reasoning. What would be perhaps another reasoning? And that's called lehislamid, which means for the purpose of teaching. If it would be necessary and meaningful to teach a child how to paint on a paper an image of the sun or the moon, then you have two reasons that you might allow such a thing. Number one, it's two-dimensional, not three-dimensional. We want to avoid three-dimensional completely. Number two, it's lehislamid. It's done for educational purposes. In the case of astronomy, it becomes a little bit more complex because now we're talking about something that's three-dimensional. And although it's done lehislamid, maybe we should be more careful about something that's three-dimensional, which according to everyone is a violation of Lo Tasun. But the Gemara says that lehislamid, for purposes of learning and education, it's okay. So the Gemara reports that Rav Gamliel wanted to teach witnesses what they would see and come and testify that they saw the new moon. So he would create an image of the moon. It was three-dimensional, but that was lehislamid in order for teaching purposes. And that was permissible. We spoke last week very briefly about photography. Imagine you take an image of a human being. Here, perhaps, we could apply a leniency that appears in the Beit Yosef. You'll see it on the pages that I gave you. And these pages, by the way, are in better shape than the ones we gave last week. So I lived up to my promise to replace last week's pages. And in the case of photography, we have a leniency in the Beit Yosef. He was anticipating what would come in later technology, and that is that you don't take a picture of a human being from head to toe. Once it's from head to toe, then you're creating an image. The only leniency we could have if it's from head to toe is, number one, that it's two-dimensional. According to that, again, we don't want to rely on that. But number two, perhaps we could say that he's not really creating the image. He's only creating a film, and that film will be sent to develop. The final image would be the developed film. That too is a little problematic, because it could be, especially here in Israel, that you're sending it to a Jew to develop the film. Well, he's creating a real image. It's only two-dimensional, but as I said, that's not enough. So it's really a good idea to avoid taking photography of a full image from head to toe of a human being. Rav Kook, in one of his tshuvas, writes that in the case of a sculpture, which is three-dimensional, even if it's not the entire body, it's only half the body, a bust that goes from the head till the waist should be avoided. He allows it at the end of the day, if need be, but he's not excited about it. Because even though it's part of the body, it's done to idolize a person, and you'll see these kind of busts, and you know these are famous giants in history, and those monuments should be avoided. Now, what happens if somebody else, not myself, creates this image? We said I'm not allowed to own the image. I can't retain ownership of it. This could be a problem for art lovers who love to buy art. I don't know if there's anyone in the room who fits that category. If there is someone, then you have to be very wealthy, because to buy a portrait of any value, if it's from head to toe, it's going to cost you good money. But buying such a thing would be a problem, even though it's only two-dimensional. But nevertheless, we said that we don't want to rely on the mekilim, on the lenient position of the shach, which you'll see here in this essay. And we're going to extend the prohibition of lotasun iti even to two-dimensional images, so that in a case where you're buying a two-dimensional piece of artwork of a full-length image of a human being, how much more so if it has in it images of stars or the sun, then now you may be violating the prohibition of shehiyah. If you remember, we discussed last week that ownership is shehiyah. So even though I didn't create this piece of art, you know, look at this beautiful piece, and you surely know that Berzon didn't create it, no way, no how, but if I'm owning it, do I violate the issur shehiyah? So here we introduced last week, and with that I'll complete my chazara on last week, the chayei adam. The Chayodom, Rabbi from Danzig, who lived about 120 years ago, 150 years ago, he's the author of the Chayodom and the Chachmas Adam. He says that the Isur Shehiyah, to maintain ownership, is not a gzera because we're afraid that you might worship this, because idol worship in our time is very rare. Although, I wonder what percentage of the human population on the globe today are idol worshippers. But be that as it may, amongst our culture, it's not common. And what's the problem then? Somebody might accuse you of having created this piece, this image. He says, you know what, if you buy a piece of art, in most cases, people are very much aware of the fact that you didn't create that piece of art, you didn't violate the prohibition of lo tasun, there's no chashad, there's nobody who's going to suspect you. And therefore, I think that we can be lenient about buying portrait paintings that are full length. To create them, I would avoid that, if it's full length. I would only rely on the Beis Yosef if it's not the full body. And even then, I'm not sure, as I mentioned last week, we have up the block here one of the great Judaic painters of our generation, and she is very careful. And what she does is she leaves out the details of the facial features. And if you buy her art, you have to realize you're not getting a realistic picture of a human being. But she does so because of the lotasev lotasun iti that enjoins us from creating an image of a human being certainly from head to toe. I'll take questions in just a few minutes because I want to get to the subject of today. All this was just a review of last week, so your questions really belong to last week's class. But this week's class is about visiting museums. And I'm talking about art museums. If you want to go to a Judaica museum, you want to go to the Diaspora Museum, that's a different story. We could discuss that in another occasion. But I'm talking about visiting, shall we say, the National Gallery in London, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. And you are an art lover, and you appreciate art, and you want to enjoy the art. The first point that I want to make is please, please avoid looking at paintings of what I call Oso Ha'ish. There are so many Christian paintings that date back centuries upon centuries. Sometimes they're collected in galleries. But even if they're not collected in galleries, which means you have to be even more careful because you can look the other way and not enter into a gallery in a museum, but the very moment you enter into a gallery, then you assume that there are no Christian paintings that might have been used in a Christian cult, and therefore you're not allowed to benefit from them because they have the status of Avodah Zarah. And when Christians classically created images, they very often bowed down to those images, even if it was a painting two-dimensional. So you want to avoid that. That's number one. Now, images on graves, or meaning on tombstones, you'll have, if you're interested, a tshuva for Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chassam Sofer, and there was a case, I mentioned it last week as well, in Prague, where the great rabbi, the chief rabbi of Prague, died, and they put an image of a human being on his tombstone. This is in the 1700s. And somebody in the 1800s complained about it to Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chassam Sofer, and he said, if I had the power, I would chop off that part of the tombstone or completely remove it. Because in a case of a kever, that's where people bow down, that's where people say Tilim, that's where they worship the Almighty. You don't want to have an image of a human being on the tombstone. But he says, you know what? If they won't allow you to take off that image, then just be careful to notify everyone that that's not a good place to pray, because you don't want to pray in front of an image of a human being. But getting back to my question about an art museum, we're going to address the following. If we assume that what we're enjoying in an art museum is not Avodah Zarah, so we're not in the galleries that date back, shall we say, 6 centuries or more, because I have to tell you that European art, up until the 1500s, was almost exclusively religious art. So what you want to do is you want to visit a museum, if you decide to do so, and I'm going to try to ask the question, why would you decide to do so? Why not instead listen to Shiurim in the OU and learn some Torah? And that's a very profound question. But if you do decide, for whatever reason, we'll call it X, the unknown, to visit a museum, then you want to look at paintings that begin in the 1600s. And I'm going to pinpoint to you the turning point. Now, there were two absolutely great artists in the 1500s that had a tremendous impact on the history of art. They were Caravaggio and El Greco. These two painters painted unbelievable art. They broke new ground in art, in their methodology. However, most of their art is Christian art. So that you can benefit indirectly from the work of Caravaggio. For example, Caravaggio was a master at light. You will see a candle and you want to blow it out because you think it's real. That was Caravaggio. And I can show you some of his artwork that's amazing. He had a tremendous impact on what's called the Dutch or Golden Period of Art, which was pretty much a century later. However, as opposed to Caravaggio, the Dutch, the Netherlands, were interested almost exclusively in secular art. The only art that really fascinated them, and when I say fascinated, almost obsessed, that was not totally secular, was biblical art. And I want to talk to you about biblical art in just a minute. But first, I want to mention the name of one great artist from the Netherlands who lived in the 1500s. And he becomes, to a certain extent, the connector, the bridge between the old-style Christian religious art that was so predominant through the history of art in Europe and the Netherlands in the 1600s. His name was Pieter Bruegel, or Bruegel. I think I have, let's see if I can find it. I can show you a number of his pieces. Again, this is just a poster. And what you'll see in this poster, he's very famous, for example, for a painting that he made of bread bakers. And you'll see in his artwork a lot of colors. It's purely secular. And it's fascinating because if you look at the painting, you will see so many different things going on in one painting. Here's another example of Bruegel. This is what's called a winter landscape. And again, this kind of a painting had a tremendous influence throughout the Netherlands in the next century, which is the 17th century. There's so many Dutch paintings I can show you that in a sense imitate Bruegel. Today, anywhere you go in the world, you will see his artwork displayed as something absolutely famous in the history of art. Because here we're at the turning point and we're going into secular art. Again, if anybody wants to pass this around, you know, if you have a camera, I would tell you to take a picture of this. Okay, these are absolutely famous paintings across the entire world. If you go, for example, today, I'm not telling you to go, but if you go to Austria today, to Vienna, you'll see half of a museum that has an exhibit right now, it's just for this period of time, of his work. Most of his paintings were absolutely large, colorful, but totally secular. And that really triggers us off into the next period of the history of art. And that starts with the great masters of Holland of the Netherlands. Now, I can ask you the following question. Who is the greatest artist in history? And I would probably get a number of different answers. Two of the answers that I would get, if you're intelligent about the history of art, both come from the same period of time, the 1600s in Holland. Does anybody know which two painters I have in mind? Rembrandt, of course, and Vermeer. Jan Vermeer. I'm going to talk to you about Jan Vermeer in just a minute. But let me just tell you this about Vermeer. He spent probably a year on every single painting. We have in total approximately world over 22 or a little bit more than that paintings from Vermeer. Each one is a masterpiece. Later on, two centuries later, there was an individual, I'm not going to go into this, who tried to imitate Vermeer and sell those paintings on the market as if they were original Vermeer. He did an unbelievable job because he was a tremendous artist on his own right, but not as great as Vermeer. Around the same time as Vermeer, we have Rembrandt. Rembrandt had a studio in which, during the course of his lifetime, he trained over 50 artists. Some of them became world famous. Now, let me just spend a minute or two to explain why secular art is something that you might want to develop an appreciation for if you don't already have one. It's totally secular. There are no images of human beings that are idolized as part of religion. There's no idol worship here. And what is the nature of art? Art is not a science in the academic sense. Anyone who's interested exclusively in rigorous mathematical analysis, that's not what art is about. But there's another side to the human being. And that is the emotions. Art is a human endeavor to create beauty. Beauty is something that appeals to our aesthetic tastes. In a sense, what beauty is all about is putting together different parts of a whole. And perhaps the whole is even greater than the sum of its parts. When a person appreciates art, what he's doing is he's almost entering into an experience of pure emotion. The artist himself, and when I say himself, it could be herself, was not always aware of the emotions that he or she was projecting. Some artists just painted whatever they felt. But the greatest works of art are those that touch your soul. The human being as God created him is made up of both mind, intellect, academic analysis, and soul. And the soul feels. And the soul very often needs expression for those feelings. They can't be cooped up. And so when a person goes to an art museum, they will probably walk from painting to painting and enjoy the fine arts, but all of a sudden, they stop in front of one painting. And I'm not sure that any two people going to a museum would stop in front of the same painting. Because that painting that you stopped in order to look at a second time and a third time touches your heart. Somehow, the emotions within are projected and they touch you. And you want to relate to that. So how does an artist go about achieving his goal of projecting emotion? He uses many different tools. And the greatest of all were able to master almost all those tools. Not everyone was able to master all of them. But things like light and color, the drama of the scene, the passion of the moment, this is all inherent in the piece of art. And herein lies the difference between Vermeer and Rembrandt. Rembrandt's art is almost exclusively emotional. He was able to capture feelings, intensity in his art. Now, as Jewish people, we should be proud of Rembrandt. Not because Rembrandt was Jewish. Rembrandt was Christian. What's fascinating is that he knew Hebrew. One of the most famous paintings of Rembrandt is called Belshazzar's Feast in the National Gallery on Trafalgar Square in London. Let me just show you, and maybe you could pass this around, a photograph of Belshazzar's Feast. This is a chapter in the book of Daniel in which Belshazzar gets a prophecy, we call it the handwriting on the wall, that he will not survive even to the next day. Here's Belshazzar. Look at the expression on his face. Look at the expression on the faces of those around him. And in order to dramatize, Rembrandt does many different things. His combination of colors, his projection of reality, of faces that are aghast when they see the hand coming down from heaven and writing a message on the wall. One of the women in this painting, and this is Rembrandt's own chiddush, is pouring a cup. She's not pouring a cup. If you look carefully, she's spilling a cup. She is so aghast that she cannot collect her own self. But the real chiddush as Jews in this painting is the way the letters are written. Mina, mina, tekel, farsim, not in classical Hebrew, from right to left, but up and down, like Japanese. My high. Ayin Sanhedrin, daf, I forget what daf it is, and the Gemara says that the letters went up and down. Whole discussion, why? Hey, wait a minute.
Anybody have a question here? Was Rembrandt in the class, in the McLearning Center, a previous class of Daf Yomi? Did he learn the second Sanhedrin? How in the world did Rembrandt know that the Hebrew letters should appear exactly as they appear in this painting?
Well, to do that painting was specific, he must have done some research into the background behind it.
Okay, you call it research, I'm going to say it a little differently. He had a Rebbe. Rembrandt had a Rebbe. Who was Rembrandt's Rebbe? Who lived across the street from him in Beerstraat? Menashe ben Yisrael. Now, Menashe ben Yisrael was one of the most influential Jews on the international scene in his time. In fact, he appears in front of Cromwell, and after centuries in which the Jews were not welcome in England, he's able to repeal that decree. This Menashe ben Yisrael, who's the author of some very important Sfarim, is Rembrandt's Rebbe. They had a very close relationship, and I have no doubt that Menashe ben Yisrael was the one who taught Rembrandt how to write Mina Mina Tekel Ufarsi. What happened to that relationship between Menashe ben Yisrael and Rembrandt? At one point, according to the historians, it went a little bit sour. Menashe ben Yisrael commissioned Rembrandt to create a painting that he would use in a smaller form, in a replica, as the inner page of the title. So you'd have the title page of his Sefer Menashe ben Yisrael that he was writing on one side, and you'd have this painting on the other side. He told Rembrandt exactly which biblical scene he wanted in the painting. But he forgot to tell Rembrandt one thing. Rembrandt depicted Almighty as a human figure. And Menashe ben Yisrael sent it back. This is not what I want. Historians debate, did he pay the commission? Did he not pay the commission? But did Menashe ben Yisrael himself ever sit as a model for a painting? The answer is yes and no. He never sat for a painting, but he did model for what's called a sketch. Rembrandt, amongst his very unique features, was absolutely a master at creating sketches. In his studio, he would teach his students how to make these sketches. But in the Gay Museum in California, there was a fascinating exhibit of sketches of Rembrandt and his students. And if you take the tour, again, the exhibit has moved on elsewhere, I don't know where it is today, the curator will show you the difference between the two. He'll challenge you. Can you tell which is Rembrandt and which is his student? Rembrandt's sketches were done very hurriedly. He was amazing. His students had to laboriously create these sketches. They would work very hard. What was Rembrandt's relationship to the Jewish nation? I want to tell you a few things. Does anybody know what Borough Park is? If you know what Borough Park is, Rembrandt lived in the Borough Park of his day on Judenstraat. We know the names of his neighbors. His neighbors were by and large Portuguese Jews who ran away after the expulsion. Why did they come to the Netherlands, to Holland? Because Holland had a very open-door policy towards religion in general. It was more of a Protestant country, and towards the Jews in particular. Historians will tell us that 30% of the models that sat for Rembrandt's paintings were Jewish. But more than that, they weren't just Jewish. They were yeshiva bachur. And I'll prove it to you if I can find what I'm looking for. If somebody could do me a favor, just hold on to this. We'll talk about Vermeer. I don't know if you can put it somewhere. Okay.
Okay. Just give me a minute, maybe I left it outside.
We'll try to find the best of all boys.
There's a very, very famous painting in the Metropolitan Museum of Art of Rembrandt, which is called Aristotle Contemplating the Bust of Homer. It's a very, very famous painting. If you go to the Met, stop and look at that painting. Because Aristotle is no doubt a yeshiva bacha, probably Portuguese. And I'd love to show you the painting, I just don't find it right this second.
Making some progress.
This painting, the original, this is just a poster, a replica, you'll see in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Next time you're in New York, go see it. I have a larger picture of him, which I can't find now. Okay. You found it on Google? Great. So take a look. Maybe you'll see it in front of you. Let me say a few words about Rembrandt's biblical art. Here's a radical change in the history of art. Rembrandt was the first great artist to use a European Jew. I'm talking about an Ashkenazi Jew, because there were Ashkenazim in Holland as well, not just Sfaradim, as Oso Ha'ish.
As what?
As Oso Ha'ish. In other words, a Jew would model as Yoshka. Now, why did Rembrandt do this? No one before him had the chutzpah to do such a thing. If you look at Christian art, which I don't tell you to do, avoid it like the plague, but you'll see, you know, these ghostly figures that look anything but Jewish. But Rembrandt knew that Yoshka was Jewish. And in his mind, an accurate portrayal of Yoshka would require a Jew. That was his first major breakthrough. Secondly, since so many of the Jews who lived in his neighborhood would commission Rembrandt to make paintings and portraits, many of Rembrandt's paintings are portraits of Jews, sometimes by title. Now, one of the Jewish people who modeled for Rembrandt is shown in a beautiful painting, very famous, called Jeremiah Mourns Over the Destruction of Jerusalem. You'll see it here in that post. If you can turn it around, people will be able to see it. Now, this same... Now again, I have a lot to say about this painting. If you look at the details, again, I have to tell you this. A poster is not worth much. What it's worth is that maybe when you see the painting in its original, you'll stop dead in your tracks. So that's my goal for you today. This model appears in another painting by Rembrandt, which is owned by the National Museum of Israel, on the campus, what's called? What do you say? No, right here in Jerusalem, the National Museum. What's it called? Israel Museum, we'll call it. Okay. Now, the Israel Museum owns only one Rembrandt. The title of the painting is St. Peter in Mourning, or something like that. Now, keep in mind, we don't always have the titles that Rembrandt gave to his own painting. That painting, in my humble opinion, is a Jewish painting that Rembrandt made of the same Yirmiyahu HaNavi who's in this painting. But the biblical art of Rembrandt is unbelievable. Now, I gave you this Belshazzar speech. Were there any other pictures that I gave you? I don't remember. Yeah, here they are. Let me just borrow this. I'll give you right back. Here's a painting. Again, you have to see the original. Of Yaakov Avinu blessing his two sons. It is one of the most touching paintings that I've ever seen. I can learn Chumash, okay, and I can certainly, you know, study the parasha, but when you see it, it just triggers off such passion. Where is Rembrandt's Chiddush? There's a tremendous Chiddush. Because not only is Yosef in the picture, but he added Yosef's wife into the picture. We don't know that she was there at the time of the brother. Here's another Chiddush. This is Yitzchak mistakenly giving a bracha to Yaakov. He really wanted to give it to Esau. In the background is Yitzchak's wife Rebecca. We don't know that she was there. So you have to be very careful. When you see Rembrandt's biblical art, you know, look at it with a critical eye, because Rembrandt was a mechadesh. Now, one of Rembrandt's contemporaries, that's the word I'm looking for, was Frans Hals. Frans Hals was a Dutch portrait painter of tremendous significance. This is, everything fell down. All right, we'll pick it up. This is a painting of a boy with a flute. Now, what you'll notice here, and this is so typical of the Dutch school, is what I call heavy, heavy brush strokes. This is one of the most profound tools that were introduced in the history of art. Instead of fine, delicate paint and strokes, they use very heavy strokes. It has an amazing impact on the viewer. So again, if anybody wants to see this, I don't know where to leave it, but leave it. Okay. I want to talk to you a little bit about, thank you, a little bit about Vermeer. Let me show you some of Vermeer. This, for example, which you'll soon see, is the lace maker. This is a girl with a red hat. This is what's called a view of Delft. That's where he lived. This is a lady riding, a woman holding a balance, and these are some of the paintings that you might want to see. Each one of these paintings is an amazing achievement, an amazing gem.
Can I just ask you something? What you said before? You're not allowed to look at full-length pictures of people.
No, again, unless it was worshipped. If it wasn't worshipped, you're allowed to enjoy it. Now, are you allowed to own it? That's a little bit more complicated. Then you have to align the head there of two dimensions. Correct? So you have a little bit of a taste of
an original. Prints are not included.
Interesting question. I don't know. Ask me after the shiur, because I have to think about that. I never thought about that.
What about full-length wedding pictures?
Again, you know, the person who took the painting, the picture, is problematic, or at least the developer of the photography, and that's something that we should be careful about.
Well, what about if you want to send you a picture of your whole family and put on the wall?
Okay, I don't know. All right. Now, I showed you a painting of Hals, right? Here's another painting of Paul's that I can show you. Again, it's a very touching scene. It's called A Boy and a Musical Instrument. Okay? Beautiful, beautiful stuff. Franz Hals was amazing. Very similar to... Sorry, I can't turn it this way because it's going to fall like all the others fell. Okay. Again, if I was doing this professionally, I would have to have... You know what they call those easels and stuff like that to hold on to? So this is something that I schlepped by myself. It's very hard. This
is one of the most famous Vermeer paintings. Okay, now I have here a book about Vermeer. Let me just show you a few things. This on the front cover is called A View of Delft. It's an absolutely amazing painting. There's just so much going on here, and you can read about it inside. Here we have some of Vermeer's famous paintings, and they reproduced it in this book. This is called A Cavalier and a Young Woman. This one is called The Milkmaid. This is called The Glass of Wine. The Little Street. This painting, The Little Street, which is a painting with a courtyard, had a tremendous influence on a contemporary of Vermeer by the name of Peter de Hoogh. He was amazing. I might be able to show you some of his work too.
Why is the book called The View of Delft? But most of these done.
This is the city of Delft,
right,
in Holland.
Yeah, I know.
But again, if you look at it in detail, it's an amazing amount of detail. You can imagine how many months he spent, if not a year, on
why,
that painting.
Why the entire book with all these other paintings in the city of Delft?
Yeah, because that's one of the most famous paintings that he did, one of the greatest achievements. So they used that painting not only for the cover but also for the title of the book.
Still a little confused by the idea that we're now looking at these pictures to have a fusion, because these are secular pictures. So somehow, before this definition, they were not secular. But there was an Islam. And now, because people realize they're secular, there was a header here.
That's not what I meant to say. I'm sorry if I misled you. I never said that this was us or it became Buddha. I'm just telling you that everything that we said last week about Lotasuni tea and there's something that relates to idol worship, that has nothing to do with secular art. That's what I wanted to point
that's
out.
That's my question, man, because how is this idea then caused the prohibition of a Jew taking a picture of his at a bar mitzvah? In other words,
again, I don't have an answer to that question. But these paintings were not made by Jews.
No, but why wasn't there a heather one? Because the situation has changed, just like the situation has changed here. You know, 1,000 years ago, this would have been like that. Now it's not.
So again, if I indicated that 1,000 years ago this was bad, then I beg your forgiveness. That was the last thing from my mind.
Well, that's a picture of an individual.
Again, we were talking about creating these pictures. I'm talking about going to the museum to enjoy these pictures. If I met Vermeer on the street, I would make a bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem, Asher Nasan Chachma Levasa Vedom. Because I'll say Chachma Bagoyim Tamen. Now, would I be allowed to make these paintings? So that depends on the following issues, if I was an artist. Number one, is it a full-length portrait? Number two, is it two-dimensional? Number three, is it l'islamic, meaning it's completely for other reasons that have nothing to do with religion or idol worship, it's purely secular? And I would have to come to some conclusion. And that's the conclusion that Boofy came to up the block, as I said, not to give any distinct features. But again, that's all for the painter. The title and the subject of our discussion today is not the painter. I just reviewed that so that I wanted to bring those who weren't here last week up to date. The topic of today is, can I enjoy the benefits of these paintings? And there was never, ever, ever a prohibition. Ever. Do you hear me, please? There was never, ever a prohibition to enjoy these paintings. And the reason for that is because these are totally secular. What's great about Vermeer is that he's able to capture a moment in a person's life, but it's such tremendous detail. It's just mind-boggling. Now, I'd like to share with you what I consider the greatest work of Vermeer. I don't know if anybody will agree with me in the history of art. And this is called The Art of Painting. I wish I could bring you to see this painting in the original. It's mind-boggling. This is it on here, on the right side, if you can look at it. What he's doing is, he's doing a portrait painting of this young woman. She's dressed up very fancy, very beautiful. He himself, the artist, is dressed up in a very unique way. And what's on the back is a map of the Netherlands. It's absolutely amazing because this map has such detail in it. But the most amazing thing here, which you can't see in this reproduction, is the perspective. You look at this painting and you will feel like you are on the spot. Again, you can't see it in this reproduction. I'm upset about that, but that's what I found. That's what I found. Now, I don't want to tell you who owned this painting. Illegal. Okay, his initials were A.H. And he was responsible for the murder of 6 million Jews. Okay, and he wanted it for himself. And after the war, it ended up in Austria. Now, you know, we know it was owned by a Jew, but don't ask. You know, this is it. Now, if you want to see some of Vermeer's paintings in a larger size, okay, you can take a look at this one. And again, there are so many details, perspective, light, there are windows, there are, in this painting, for example, I don't know if you can see, it didn't come out too well, but there are drapes over there. He gave you the feeling that you're peeking in, so to speak, so the drapes are partially removed. The floor is incredibly complicated. So why would I want to visit a museum?
Which museum is that?
This is in the Kutscherstadt Museum in Austria. And if you're able to get to the painting, you're lucky because there are mobs of people who are coming to see this painting.
Is that Vienna?
In Vienna. Now, one of the more famous paintings of Vermeer is called The Girl with a Pearl Earring. Okay, then? Okay.
That's right. Before that was
the
wall.
Where is it? Oh, here. Thank you so much. It's right in front of my nose. I'm not organized. This is also a very famous Vermeer painting. Now, this is in the Frick. I don't know if you've ever seen Fifth Avenue in New York. There's a Frick collection. This was a billionaire who left his entire collection for the city of New York. And he owned, I think, 3 Vermeers, which is very unusual. So you'll see on 2 sides here different paintings by Vermeer. But this is probably the most famous of Vermeer's paintings in contemporary life. You know why? Because they made a movie out of it. So this is a subject of a movie. Again, you can't get the feeling of this painting.
It's 3-dimensional. It's almost 3-dimensional.
Yeah. That's what Vermeer is all about. Rabosa, I'm going to tell you something, and you won't believe me. Vermeer's contemporaries believed that he was a magician. That it was humanly impossible to create the paintings that he painted. In fact, in the history of art, Vermeer's paintings are known to be greater than photographs. You will get a more precise picture of something through Vermeer than you will in a photograph, the most expensive camera in the world. It's just mind-boggling what he was able to put on a canvas.
But if it's three-dimensional, isn't that also
a problem? No, it's not. It's not really three-dimensional. It looks like three-dimensional, but it's not three-dimensional. Again, keep in mind, Michael, when you say it's a problem, you'll call up Vermeer and tell him he violated the Easter of Lotas. You know? But again, I don't even know if Vermeer is included in the Easter of Lotas. Last week, maybe some of you might remember that I mentioned one of the most famous paintings in art history, which would be a problem for the painter, but trust me, he was not Jewish, he was Dutch. And that's a painting that depicts stars. Do you remember what that is called? That is Van Gogh's
Van Gogh.
Okay, in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Starry Night. Okay, that was the Starry Night that fell on the floor. So again, I'm going to have a heck of a challenge. Now, by the way, I'm focused today to a large extent on the Dutch, but I do want to mention a Spaniard, and his name is Velasquez. If you know about him, he's also one of the greatest painters in the history of art. Also very powerful, very
beautiful. And I found out just recently that his father was, again, I don't know whether to call him Jewish, but his father was what they call the conversos. In other words, his father was a descendant of Jewish people who were Muranos, that during the persecution, they accepted upon themselves Christianity. But he's one of the most famous painters in history. So let me say a few things about Rembrandt and about the history of art and why I would want to go to an art museum and appreciate art. First of all, I said to you that the greatest artists were able to capture emotion. I'm going to show you a few examples of this. Rembrandt painted his mother many times. She was an elderly woman. It's amazing. He has her studying the Bible. You can actually see the Bible in very, if you look carefully, in very fine terms. This is a study of a man. If you get a chance to look at this, I mean, it is so powerful. But what Rembrandt was unique about was what we call self-portraits. Rembrandt, during his lifetime, painted no less than 90 self-portraits. And it's like a history of his life. And in some of his portraits, you will see so much emotion and so much feeling. And it evokes that feeling in those who appreciate his art. It's interesting that this book on Rembrandt's self-portraits, which takes you through the whole history of his life, because he did these self-portraits, he probably sat in front of a mirror and painted as he watched himself. The cover on this book is that painting that I showed you before, which is called Jeremiah Mourns the Loss of the Destruction of the Vintage. This is an amazing painting. I mean, again, if you just want to get a feeling of the power of Rembrandt, this is a detail of a much larger painting. Just look at this. I mean, if you don't make a bracha when you meet Rembrandt, I don't know, then I haven't succeeded at all. It's just amazing, the feeling, the fine lines. I mean, you could see the twinkle in his eye. You could see so much feeling. Now, what's great about the history of art is that an artist will give you just enough to get your imagination moving, but not too much. Meaning, he'll leave out certain details, and you have to make the story. And there's so many great artists in the history of art who were able to do this. One of those people was an American artist by the name of Homer. I don't know if you've heard of him. Anyway, he has a painting, which I think I have somewhere here, in which he shows a person saving someone who is about to drown. There is so much light and so much detail and so much color. Now, how do the artists use color when they want to evoke feelings? If they use very dark colors with strong brushstrokes, then they are either conveying feelings of depression or something very serious or solemn is going on. So when I say that a visit to a museum could be therapeutic if a person ever is suffering from despair at certain points of his life, sometimes. Now, one of the greatest painters who was able to do this was Picasso. Now, I'm not a big fan of Picasso, but he was amazing. And he created a whole movement in art which is called Cubism and had a tremendous impact on the modern history of art. And he has pictures of the human face which is so distorted that you really could feel with his harsh, heavy strokes and colors, you feel the anguish of the person in the painting. And that too is like an expression. So why go to an art museum? So I want to suggest the following. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created this world. And the purpose of beauty, Yafet Elokim liYefes, v'Yishkol lo lishem, is that even though Yefes, which represents perhaps the European culture, are absolutely amazing at art and beauty, they created the great works of edifices and sculptures and fine art. But nevertheless, something spills over for the Jewish people. And that's what Jewish art is about, which is not the subject of my discussion today. When I enjoy a painting, It gives my soul an expression. If that painting touches my heart, first of all, if man is great, if Vermeer could create a painting of this sort, which is magical, and we still don't know exactly how he did it, even to this day, then God is great. And if I could be uplifted by these paintings, then it's an amazing experience. Beauty means that all the pieces of the puzzle fit together, as I said at the outset. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Klal Yisrael made up of 12 tribes. Each tribe has its own unique personality and its own contribution. The whole is when you have all the tribes together. There's a concept in halacha called Noi Mitzvah, the beauty of a mitzvah. We are called upon to beautify a mitzvah. Get a beautiful esrog, get a beautiful talis, a beautiful sefer Torah. Beauty triggers off within us a certain, I behold something that's great, that's something that goes perhaps even beyond myself, something that's divine. God gave man chachma. He gave him wisdom. Wisdom means both intellectual knowledge, abstract, rigorous analysis, but it also means the wisdom of art. And that wisdom, as we said at the outset, is not academic, but it's very unique. There are so many powerful experiences that a person could enjoy if he only chooses carefully where and what he wants to see. If he's guided and he doesn't over-exaggerate, then this can be something that complements his experience as a Jew. Always being careful, especially in biblical art, to look at biblical art with a critical eye, to avoid Christian art, to look for art that uplifts man. Take a Dutch painting, what's called genre, still life. It brings you into someone's house. They're ordinary citizens. But see the way they live, see the way they work, the way they're dedicated with tremendous intensity. This is one dimension of what art is all about. So I know my time has run out. It's going to take me 15 minutes to put together everything here. Anyone who wants to help me, I'd be obliged. In any event, my blessing to you, and this is true for all Chachma, is that although we have to dedicate ourselves to the study of Torah, but a human being is made up of many different elements, and sometimes he needs to expose himself or herself to the chachma, if it's used in the proper way and channeled, to appreciate God, to appreciate man, to appreciate man who is created by God, to appreciate creations of beauty, the amazing potential of man to do such a thing, to allow us to vent our emotions and identify with the passions in a painting. Yehi ratzon may it be His will, and in that way, we'll be able to complement and expand and embellish our avodas Hashem. Kein yehi ratzon. Amen.